An hour later, pulling into our driveway, my parents still fighting, I saw her again at the top of our street. It would have been impossible for her to have beaten us back there on foot. My mother went inside and spent the evening baking pies. My father ate them out of spite until he got sick. I was made to deliver the remainder to neighbors. This was not long before Kareem's mother got pregnant. Even during the pregnancy, she walked. And for a while, people around town hoped that having a child would be good for her. She went missing sometimes, hospitalized for one reason or another, and Kareem lived with his father. I hadn't even thought about her in years until I saw Kareem's face on the news. He was a high school senior, but I remembered his sad, precocious eyes. I remembered seeing him once, walking alongside his mother for who knows how long, his own bag over his shoulder, and the two of them talking as if everything were normal and would be just fine. October. I met Angie Sparks at the New Faith Bible Church. I'd called her to say I was interested in giving salvation a shot, and she invited me to join her for a service. Angie gave me another pamphlet. This one was also about how the world was going to end. After you find God, he gives you a box full of pamphlets, and the rest is up to you. The Reverend hugged me. His name was Chet. His skin felt like old newspapers. Later, I learned he had sworn off drinking water because he thought it would bring him closer to God. In his vestments, he looked like a haggard crow. He looked like a bird, pretending to be a man. "Tell me about the end of the world," I said. Angie told me about her visions. When she prayed in her home, she concentrated very deeply until she saw images of the future. She knew how all of her acquaintances would die. Most people die unremarkably. An organ stops working. A stranger's car makes a left turn against a red light. We run out of oxygen. A tumor drains our life away. "You'll be the first of us to go," Angie said. "I'm sorry to tell you. I've seen it so many times now. Satan's army arrives on Earth, and you're standing right there in front of them, and they just trample you. You get trampled." She held my hand like a doctor delivering news of terminal cancer. God knows exactly what's going to happen, and sometimes he slips hints to the prophets. But it's impossible to distinguish between prophets and madmen. There were 20 other people in the room. They were mostly white, and mostly men, and mostly poor, though most people I knew were poor. The other church members' clothes didn't fit quite right. Their skin didn't fit quite right. We sat in a circle, and Reverend Chet led us in prayer. He told us about the apocalypse, about the horsemen and the dragons and the lake of fire. When the world ends, we become collateral damage, incinerated in the crossfire between the archangels and hell's minions. When Chet spoke about the apocalypse, his face turned red and sweaty. He vibrated with anticipation. He jumped out of his seat and paced laps around us. He turned his back and shouted up at the ceiling.
"I don't like having all this knowledge," he said. "I'd like to be like you were, like all those people out there, to go home and watch TV and not even think about the end of the world, to listen to pop music and eat candy all night long, to pet dogs and cats, to go outside without seeing the signs everywhere, without feeling the clammy handshake of demons, without seeing the faces of God's fallen angels on our street corners. But this is my curse. And my mission." He fell to his knees and crawled to me, grabbing my hand. "I know you can feel it too. You see that the sun is gone. You feel the cold. How much longer can we survive in a world like this?" Every day it got colder. Even indoors we all wore our jackets. "I need you to place your hand on my head right now and feel the knowledge radiating from me. I want to transfer it to you," he said. And I did.
and I waited to feel it. He strained and pushed, and I waited.
"Do you feel it?"
he shouted again and again, until I pulled my hand back as if I'd just touched a hot stove. I said I'd felt it. I wanted to have felt it. To tell you the truth, I was hoping he'd have a more unique vision. Horsemen and fire and everything else had been done before. If I could give notes to him, I'd tell him, punch it up a little, surprise the people. He kissed me on the mouth and then spun away, continuing his sermon. He asked Jesus to come back to earth and free us all from the shackles of our imperfect bodies. He said we were God's warriors, preparing to fight the battle against evil. He said we were willing to do anything to bring about God's kingdom on earth. I bowed my head and mouthed my amens at the appropriate times. I pictured myself in my heavenly armor, with my heavenly spear. I pictured the devils with their hellish armor and hellish spears. I imagined being devoured by a fiery hellhound, its fangs plunging into my deep tissue and filling me with venom. I thought maybe it would be easiest if I just found a good hiding place and rode out the storm. When the end times come, you have to pick a side, but there's no way of knowing who's going to win. After the prayer session, there was more prayer. Each person was asked to say some things about God and describe their personal struggle. The first man said he'd spent the whole week banging on doors and warning people. He was arrested once for being too aggressive in delivering the good news. The police these days had little tolerance for unexplained aggression. He also mentioned that his water heater was on the fritz, which had been a real hindrance, shower-wise. "You go door to door looking like the smelly hobo guy and people don't listen to you," he said. The next man had been recently fired. He described his boss as a godless bitch who couldn't deal with him spreading the truth about our crumbling world. He wanted to get revenge on her first, then he would repent. When it was my turn to pray, I told them all I wanted was to know how to feel safe again. I said I wasn't sure who was even in the government, let alone how they were supposed to help me. I said I was going to buy a telescope so I could find a planet more hospitable to human life. I didn't know when I was supposed to stop talking or how to signal I was done. I made the sign of the cross and then sat down. My mother was a difficult woman to love. It was unclear whether she even wanted to be loved. When I was 13, she bought a deli, even though she'd never owned a business in her life. It was her favorite deli when she was growing up. The owners had no heirs and were retiring, so my mother bought the place on the spot. The meager price cleaned out her savings, and she didn't consult with my father. One day she went out for sandwiches and came home with a deed. She had memories of her father lifting her up to the counter so she could eat samples of cheese, and she wanted to buy those memories back. During the next 4 years, we rarely saw her, because she was out the door by sunrise and home long after the dinner rush. My mother was a whisper, and my father was a phantom. He was there, but you could see through him. I took care of my brother, whom I had begun learning to love, and tried to wish myself into a different life. At the end of the day, my mother would come home and open a bottle of Moscato and sit on the end of the couch, swirling the wine in her mouth, coating her tongue in the sticky sweetness. She made sounds like a purring cat and said, "Mama earned you today," and then she poured herself another glass. Soon she asked me to just bring the bottle to her, and then she grabbed my face with her hands and studied my eyes. She asked if I was smoking marijuana and laughed at me when I said no. Then she leaned in and kissed me on the forehead. Her hands smelled like raw onions and her breath like wine. And still, that smell is the first thing I remember when I think of her. During that same winter, my father lost his job again.
He'd been laid off 10 years earlier and had spent most of my life stringing together one bad job after another. After being fired this time, he went out with the boys from work, and while we were eating dinner he came trundling through the door, his pockets stuffed with loose cigarettes he'd won in a low-stakes poker game. He took a plate of food and carried it to the couch, where he ate by himself. My mother did not even acknowledge he existed. She said nothing to anyone until after I put my brother to bed and then pretended to sleep myself. I sneaked out of my room to listen, sure they would have a terrible fight. He was on the couch, barely conscious from the booze. She sat next to him and said, very calmly, "I will not allow you to turn my life into a cliché." She left him there, and I heard him crying. Later, my father told me she'd held a knife to his throat when she said it. He was never an honest man, but I always believed him more than anyone else. In our family, we didn't talk about love. When I was young, if I told my mother I loved her, she would nod and say, "That's nice." Sometimes she would say, "You know how I feel about you?" Love is an illness. Thinking in terms of love and not love is a mistake. The questions to ask yourself are, do these people make me feel better or worse? How much are these people going to hurt me? And how much can I hurt them back? We were raised to believe in the inherent goodness of the place where we lived, but Seldom Falls was never a great place. It was always just a place. My brother lost his faith in it before I did. He always knew how ugly places can be when people think they're safe. The media reminded us constantly that safe, happy places aren't actually safe or happy, so much as they're deluded into believing they are. But it's such a comforting delusion to think that if you retreat to the right city, then suddenly you're free of all the dangers. You can build a fort with 20-foot-high walls, but you can't keep the wilderness out. I brought Robbie with me to the gun expo at the East Township Convention Center because we needed to get out of the house and because Reverend Chet had asked me to acquire some weapons for the church. They were stockpiling an arsenal. Neither of us had ever fired a real gun. Robbie played paintball on weekends and as a teenager had made some extra cash playing semi-professionally. He enjoyed the thrill of the chase, the opportunity to play-act murdering his friends. He enjoyed being shot and surviving. There was enough weaponry in the East Township Convention Center to eradicate the species of your choice. It took God 40 days and 40 nights to wipe the earth clean of almost everyone. But it would take Robbie and me only a few hours if we set our minds to it. There were so many vendors, it was impossible to know where to begin. At least 20 rows of tables, all with their own colorful displays and patterned tablecloths and stacks of paperwork, and groggy salesmen nursing coffee and checking their phones every couple minutes. If not for the hundreds of men fondling guns, it would have looked exactly like any other convention. The first table we passed was selling a new scope that allowed shooters to magnify potential targets from 100 feet farther away than ever before. A poster showed a before-and-after image, first of an empty field, and then a close-up of an oblivious deer's face. Presumably that particular deer hadn't been shot after the photo was taken, and he never knew how close he'd come to being killed for sport. He just munched on grass and looked for doe, and then rubbed his antlers on a tree. He trotted into the woods and later lay down safely at night, and never knew that he was one twitch of an index finger away from having had a bullet implanted in his brain, his skin removed and turned into wallets, his meat stripped away from the bone and salted and dried and turned into jerky, his head sawed off and mounted on a piece of wood, and then hung on display in someone's sitting room. The scope seemed like a very good tool for someone who wanted to kill from very far away. I was sure the FBI was still watching me. I knew there would be undercover agents at the gun expo,
dressed in John Deere hats and ill-fitting jeans. I was one of probably 100 people in the room, being monitored for potential activities deemed dangerous to the state. There is no such thing as being removed from the threat list. You can get downgraded, but you're still in the system. Many booths displayed signs that said, "Are you prepared?" I was not prepared. That was the whole problem. Their pamphlets and videos told stories of terrified women enduring home invasions, of being tied up and gagged, and feeling powerless while the invader ransacked their house and made off with family heirlooms, of being sexually assaulted and left for dead. "All across the country," the narrator of one video said, "innocent families are in danger." They showed a montage of potential perpetrators, drug addicts, illegal immigrants, perverts, terrorists, sociopaths. "This country is in crisis," the narrator said. "There's only one way to ensure your safety." The men in this room were prepared with every kind of survival tool imaginable. Traps to arrange on your lawn. Tactical pants with built-in tourniquets in case you sustain a serious leg wound. Kits for making decoy versions of yourself so you could get the drop on invaders. They were like Boy Scouts, but with more weapons. By the end of our walk through the first row, I could barely breathe. The people in this room were invested in creating a mania of fear and then promising they had the solution. What would I do if someone broke in? What would Robbie do? A kitchen knife is no defense against a criminal with a handgun. You needed to be better equipped than the criminals. You needed to stop thinking of guns as guns and start thinking of them as a home defense system. I told Robbie I had to leave. Just being in the room filled me with a dread I didn't think I could ever forget. We didn't buy any guns. The thought of exchanging money for a gun made me want to drive my car off the road and into the lake. If I were alone with a gun, I don't know what would happen. The gun would talk to me, and I would not know how to respond, and it would tell me things, and I would believe them all. I would do whatever it told me to do. At Robbie's apartment, we pulled the cushions off the couch and flipped it on its side, then draped a sheet over it like a roof. We sat in our shelter and ate beans out of a can and drank half a bottle of cognac. We discussed what we would miss most about the outside world. Robbie said he would miss birds. My answer was traffic lights, seeing them change from green to red and back again. They made so much sense. Sometimes with Robbie, I would find myself having a pleasant conversation and then feeling suddenly overwhelmed by the urge to hit him, to destroy something in his face. I don't know why. He was not a man who deserved to have his face destroyed. And yet, the feeling would creep up in me like a need to vomit. Sitting in the bomb shelter, I had to focus all my energy on suppressing the urge to shatter Robbie. In these moments, in the desire for senseless violence and the promise of relief at the sight of someone else in pain, I never felt more masculine. But violence doesn't cure violence. It creates violence. If I hit him, he would hit me back, and then I would hit him again, and eventually one of us would have to kill the other. The shooter owned many video games, and he listened to a very aggressive genre of music. It became conventional wisdom to blame his preferred entertainments for the mass murder. A group of concerned parents gathered at the center of town to hold a bonfire. Parents were encouraged to bring questionable entertainments and throw them into the fire. It would be a mass exorcism. The event was held at the clock tower on Main Street. When I was a teenager, Seldom Falls had built the clock tower in an effort to help revitalize downtown. But nobody goes downtown to see a clock. There was a period in human history when not knowing the time was normal. There was a time when all the news you heard came from your neighbors, and the only things you knew about the rest of the world came from books. Since the sun's disappearance, The cold had settled so deeply into my bones that I had forgotten what it was like to be warm. I didn't shiver anymore. I just felt a coldness like the heart of a crocodile. I felt myself some nights turning into a crocodile, scales forming on my skin, my eyes going glassy and my teeth clenching in a malevolent grin. I felt a strong desire to submerge myself in a lagoon and linger motionless, only my eyes peeking above the surface while I waited for my prey to swim directly into my mouth. I went to the bonfire because I was tired of the cold. The city council had called on the governor to officially declare a state of emergency. Even though they had installed powerful lights and heat lamps everywhere, they couldn't replace the sun. 6 months of sunlessness had ruined all the crops. People had never quite adjusted. We were maladjusted. The steady darkness interspersed with occasional cones of artificial light was disorienting. Other cities still had a sun. I'd seen it. I took a bus across state lines just to confirm, and there it was. There were people in bathing suits at poolside, and people with sunburns, and people sweating through their shirts. How could the sun leave one place, but not another? On the stage behind the bonfire pit, a woman yelled into a megaphone, "We must end violence today!" And people cheered. I cheered too. "Where does violence come from?" she said. And some people shouted answers, even though it was clearly a rhetorical device. "It comes from giant corporations feeding our children slop, from video games that teach us not to value human life, movies about zombies and TV shows about serial killers, music with coded messages teaching kids how to kill." She bent down to a pile at her feet and grabbed a handful of video games. "My own son went to that school. It could have been him who was killed. It could have been him who turned out to be the killer." She tossed the games into the fire pit while a pair of men sprayed lighter fluid on it. "We need to reject these evil entertainments and purify ourselves," she shouted. The fire started slowly, and then suddenly roared upward as people tossed more and more garbage into it. The smoke was black and acrid. Nobody had anticipated the toxic smell of hundreds of pounds of burning plastic. Even breathing the air around the fire felt dangerous. Arms of flame leaped out of the pile as if trying to grab the nearest bystander. I kept getting closer. I wanted to sweat. I wanted to break the fever of the past few months. I stood so close to the fire I felt like I was inside it. The fire was the first thing I'd felt in weeks that wasn't fake. It was real and simple, and it could have killed me if an officer hadn't shoved me backward. Each time there was another shooting, they told us the cause was a mystery, and there was nothing we could have done about it, except pray that it didn't happen again. To say something, if we saw something. On the morning news, they discussed what to do if you found yourself in an active shooter situation. The best thing to do was not to shelter in place, as they used to teach, but to run to the nearest exit.
"Put as much distance between yourself and the bullets as possible," the detective on TV said. "If there are bodies, step over them. Do not tend to the bodies.
Leave the bodies behind. Use the bodies as a shield if it comes to that." 7 dead, in a mall in the Ann Arbor suburbs. 1 dead, 13 wounded at a high school in Oakland. 4 dead, 2 critical at a Little League baseball game in Tallahassee. 5 dead outside an elementary school in Greensboro. 15 shot. The newspaper said, sprayed by bullets, which made it sound almost nice, by an assault rifle at a political rally in Tempe. Before the blood dries and clots, there's another one to report. Somewhere right now there is a boy acquiring a gun. There is a boy writing a manifesto. There is a man, angry at having been forgotten, at having been passed over, at finding out what life really is, loading his gun. There is a man fortifying his home and preparing for war. Listen, and you can hear the hammers being cocked. Because people kept getting murdered in places where murder isn't supposed to happen, the president announced he was going to take a tour of the massacre sites. He said, "This wave of violence is a great shame in the history of our great nation," and he pledged to keep us safe. He never said the word gun. He never said the word murder. He kept saying tragedy. It was as if he were talking about the weather. He spoke of the virtues of small-town America. The politicians loved small towns. They thought all we did was sit around eating apple pie and waving flags in our churches. They didn't like to think about everyone taking opiates and working bad jobs and living in a constant state of fear. Their love for Main Street, USA, was malignant. We were dying, and they were getting rich off of it while they praised us for our resilience. They stopped to have a beer with a local. They ate something deep-fried. They promised that next time they came through, they would bring prosperity with them. The president would be in Seldom Falls in 6 weeks. Another envelope from Calvin arrived. This time it contained a check. I don't know how he had money to spare. I also didn't know how I was going to continue paying my bills without his help. The destructive part of my brain told me to tear it up and toss it into the wind. I hated the thought of my younger brother having to take care of me. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I kept the check. I texted him. I said, "No more charity." November. Robbie was concerned about my mental state. He said,
"Babe, I'm concerned about your mental state."
He put his hand on my face and made me look at him. It was one of the most sincere gestures he'd ever made. I wished he weren't wearing a backward hat when he did it. I wished he looked more like someone's father, with gray hair around his temples and gray eyes haunted by the war, and a mouth like a tightrope stretched between the towers of his cheekbones. I wanted him to be my father. With his cold hands and his broken tooth and his Michelob breath and his distant, useless love. I grabbed the remote and turned on the TV. He took it from me and turned it back off.
"You have to do something about it," he said. "You are not healthy."
"Isn't everyone unhealthy? Health is a condition of being between unhealthful periods." I told him I would get better. I just needed time.
"You can't just wait for things to get better."
He wanted me to see a therapist, get some meds, start keeping a diary. I told him I would think about it. But what would I get from a psychiatrist besides more judgment? Why did I need another person to perform for, another person to tell me what I was doing wrong? Now Robbie wanted me to spend time sitting in an office doing what? Talking about myself? Trying to open up my brain and hoping it didn't spill all over the floor? It's not as if I'd never been to therapy before. When I was a freshman, my teachers accused me of acting up in class. They said I'd become a troublemaker. Outbursts and failures of decorum.
"It's just hormones," my father said.
The principal scheduled a weekly appointment with the school therapist. I would be held back a grade if I didn't comply. The therapist was a man in his late 20s who spent most of his time telling me this was not the job he'd signed up for.
"I didn't go to school for 8 years so I could help little girls get over their breakups," he said.
Our meetings lasted only a half hour, and every week I told him I just wanted to be angry for a while, but I would be better soon. He made me keep an anger journal, but never checked it. Sometimes he talked about his girlfriend, who was pressuring him to buy her an engagement ring.
"What's the fucking rush with women anyway? Have you ever even met a happy married person?" he said.
I told him I had not.
"Something happens to women when they get to their 20s," he said.
They change. They go from being fun and open-minded to being some other thing. They turn miserable.
I sat quietly, waiting until I was given permission to leave.
My advice to you is to enjoy the age you are now instead of always being mad about it. Girls your age are perfect, and they don't even know it.
He started showing up late for our meetings, and a month later, he was gone. They said he just left town one night without telling anyone. Robbie started leaving the phone numbers for therapists on the coffee table, and when that didn't work, he markered a number on my hand while I slept. And when that didn't work, he went ahead and called someone nearby to make an appointment. When they called to confirm, I canceled. I told them they had the wrong number. I told them Anna Crawford had died years ago. In the time I'd known Robbie, I had never seen him yell. When he got angry, he would sulk and stop talking and pick at his toenails. He would be unresponsive for a few hours and eventually talk to me about something else. But when I told him I'd canceled the appointment, he yelled. He smashed my phone on the floor. He held my face in both of his hands and he leaned in to direct the words straight into my brain. And he said, "You are not allowed to be like this anymore," he said. "You are letting this thing turn you into a terrible person." He pushed me, and I stumbled backward, falling into the wall. His face had transformed into something dangerous. It was the face of a man who wanted to pummel the sadness out of me. He stared at me for a while, and I wanted to stare back, but I was afraid. If he wanted to, he could punch right through my face and shatter all the little bones. He yelled a profanity and then kicked the coffee table several times. He limped out of the room. I compromised. I consulted a therapist online. She interacted with me through a chat bubble. She sent me links to helpful resources and said things like, "How are you feeling today?" Like, "We can talk about whatever you want to talk about." And, "Your reaction is totally reasonable." She was using a script, but it was a good script. We talked a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder. We talked about how it manifests, the way it causes people to live in denial of their pain, to suffer occasional horrifying flashbacks, to feel guilt for having survived a trauma. When she logged off, she said, "I know you're going to be okay." She didn't know that, but it was a nice thing to say. I read a book once about a man who'd lost the capacity for memory, who every morning started with a blank slate. The book treated it as a tragedy, and the character eventually had some sort of surgery to try to correct it. But the condition struck me as a blessing. The deepest miseries come from our capacity for remembering. If everything can be wiped away with a single swipe, then nothing has to hurt. We never have to know whom we've wronged, who has wronged us, who should be there, but is no longer there. Before April, if you had asked me to pick someone in town who would have been responsible for a mass shooting, I would have picked Skip G. I met him years ago when he worked at the pet store, during my ill-fated effort at owning a cat. Skip worked the register, and he seemed very knowledgeable about pet supplies. He told me he'd sampled every food in the place, because if it's good enough for his babies, then it should be good enough for him. I asked him many questions, because I'd never owned a pet before. He thought I was flirting. If you smile more than once at a man, he assumes you are in love with him. Eventually, I agreed to a date. It was the least I could do. Our date began with cheeseburgers and beers and ended at his apartment, where he introduced me to his babies. In three different glass aquariums, he kept three constrictor snakes. They had names, Zeus and Kong and Larry, who was named after one of the Three Stooges. He asked if I wanted to hold one. I did not want to hold a snake, and yet, even as I was responding, he was placing Larry on my shoulders. Its oily weight made my legs buckle. Snakes are a single giant muscle, wrapped around a core of pure evil, denser than the mass that led to the Big Bang. I felt it moving. My eyes were closed because I was trying to leave my body. Its tongue flicked out and touched my hand, and I hoped that I would dissolve and turn into a vapor that would float out the window and into the atmosphere, and eventually return as rain. I died 1,000 times over the next 5 minutes, as he took pictures of me with his phone. "That is so sexy," he said. "A beautiful woman and a snake? Can you think of anything more primal?" He finally removed it. "I think Larry likes you," he said. To be liked by a snake was not my greatest ambition. Now I wish I'd thrown the snake at him. Now I wish I'd wrapped myself around the snake preemptively and choked it to death. But I stood there trying to be nice. I was still young. I still thought being cooperative was a virtue. Now I wish I'd left the house immediately and never come back. But I didn't know how to leave politely. I even went on a second date with him. He called me for months afterward, and I kept answering, because I didn't know how to make him go away. As I got older, I stopped seeing people for how they presented themselves publicly. Some people appear nice and normal in public, and then you glimpse their unsettling inner life. Friendly, safe men looked suddenly like men who would breed spiders or sleep in a coffin or wear a vial of blood around their neck for good luck. Strangers began to look like loaded guns, cocked and ready to fire. My job is to not be difficult. My whole life I've done things not because I want to do them, but because a good woman learns to shut her mouth and go along with it. When I was in college, I worked at an ice cream shop with a manager named Doug, who insisted I give him a hug at the end of every shift. "Time for Doug's hugs," he would announce, and we all had to line up and hug him goodnight, like we were toys he played with and then put away before going to bed. He didn't know any better, my co-workers said. It wasn't worth starting a whole big thing, they said. In a country that I couldn't locate on the map, a school was raided, and all the children were kidnapped by a terrorist group. The boys were featured in propaganda videos, smiling with gaps in their teeth as a powerful bearded man handed them assault rifles and had them point at a target, on which they'd affixed a picture of our president. The terrorists are all boys, armed with God and guns and hate and desperation. If they'd been born in another place, they might spend their evenings chatting with girls online and watching music videos and generating endless variations on memes. They would spend their mornings cramming for geometry tests and repeating lines from movies to their friends and sneaking out of class to have a cigarette. They would sometimes have an active shooter drill where they would practice hiding from a madman with a gun. They would have pizza for lunch, and they would go to track practice after school. They would eat dinner with their parents and watch popular sitcoms. But they were born in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's all that matters. Now they sell heroin, and they sell girls, so they can buy more guns and explosives, and most of those boys will die before they turn 20. Some will do it intentionally, because they've been told it is God's will. The girls would become sex slaves. They would be forced to cook and clean and fuck these men who had declared war on the entire world. In our country, there was talk of rescuing them, but it seemed beyond impossible. Every few weeks they show you a picture of a person you never knew existed. They say, "He was a very bad man." They say, "We killed him." They say this makes you safer, and you have to believe them, because either you're safer or you're not. In Rome, Someone drove a truck into a crowd that was watching a soccer game in a public square. One of the major terrorist groups had claimed responsibility. But then another group did too, and nobody could agree on who should get credit for the deaths. Nobody could agree who the enemy was. The truck had injured 10 people and killed 6. On the news, they called it a bloodbath. The average body holds 8 pints of blood, and the average bathtub holds about 40 gallons of liquid. For something to be rightly called a bloodbath, then 320 pints of blood would need to be spilled, or 40 whole humans' worth. The truck attack barely qualified. It was more like a blood sink. It's important to be precise, to know exactly how much blood there is and how much is being spilled. You don't want to sensationalize it. A group of senators began pushing for a preemptive war. Wars start because powerful men get bored and they get old. They're afraid of dying, so they try to kill as many people as possible while they still can. Their slogan was, "Something should happen." They used it on social media. They hashtagged it. They repeated it on the news. The pundits agreed. A bad thing had happened, and now, in response, another thing should happen. It was hard to dispute. On the question, should things continue to happen, or should they not continue to happen, these senators had taken a firm stand. They refused to offer specifics on what that something should be, on the grounds that giving away their plans would only empower our enemies. But it seemed to me like what we really needed was fewer things. Things had been happening for so long, and so many of them had gone badly. What if nothing happened for a very long time? What if we agreed to stop things in general? When a Muslim man did the killing, the TV showed videos of groups of angry Muslim men, shouting at cameras and waving guns in the air. The pundits debated whether it was possible to trust someone who believed in the God they believed in. When a black man did the killing, they asked why other black men weren't doing more to stop them. They interviewed sociologists about what had caused such corruption in the souls of young black men. When a white man did the killing, they called him a lone wolf. The white male lone wolf is an apex predator. Lone wolves stalk our suburbs and our schools, and they aren't in sheep's clothing. They're out in the open. Is there a total amount of violence that can be spread throughout the planet at a given time? Is there even a point in remembering the names of the victims? We didn't hear about most of the carnage overseas. We only got international news when something nightmarish happened. If it was terrorism, then they told us about it, and they told us it could come here next. They asked what our leaders were doing to combat terror. They used terror as a noun, a verb, an adjective. They wore terror like a suit of armor. There are only so many massacres you can handle before you lose hope. The world is in a prolonged state of massacre, and the only thing we can do is try not to see it all at once. The president would arrive in a week. Seldom Falls had begun security preparations, closing streets, towing cars, installing even more cameras. We received letters from local officials about how to stay safe during this visit. They said to avoid the area entirely, to stay with relatives outside of town if possible. Calvin must have been reading the same news as me, because he called the next night and said, "You can stay with me if you need to get out of town." I told him I was just going to lay low. I didn't tell him I was at Robbie's place, or that Robbie existed. I didn't want either of them to know about the other. It seemed too complicated. "Listen," he said, "I've been thinking. What if you move out here?" "This is not a good time to talk about things like that." "You could stay with us until you find your own place. We could actually see each other." I hung up. I searched my phone for a button to undo the conversation I'd just had. but I could not find it. Technology does so many things, but almost none of them are useful. The media descended on us 2 days before the president arrived. I stayed at Robbie's apartment, hoping they wouldn't be able to find me. A producer for one of the major networks had been leaving me voicemails every day for the past month. She wanted to give me an opportunity to tell my side of the story. I closed the blinds and sat inside our cushioned bomb shelter and tried to be inconspicuous. Robbie wouldn't turn the TV off. He was fascinated by watching video of places he saw every day.
"Babe," he said, "check it out. They're over by Eddie's house."
He turned the volume up so I could hear his friend being interviewed. The reporter wanted to know if he thought the town was healing. Eddie said everyone was more cautious now, but he thought we all had become stronger than ever. He repeated the slogan Mayor Randy had been promoting, "We will not be defeated." Eddie added that he'd been praying more lately. He said God has a plan for us all.
"Oh, wow, I have to text him," Robbie said when the segment ended.
I took the remote and changed the channel.
"Come on, don't be like that," Robbie said. "You have to see the fun in this."
People think I don't have a sense of humor, but I have one. Here's a joke. A gun walks into a bar. The bartender pours it a beer and says,
"You new in town?"
Then the gun shoots him in the face, because it is a gun. Someone knocked on Robbie's door. I thought it might be Angie or Reverend Chet. I had been avoiding their phone calls since the gun show. I'd failed to buy their guns, and I knew they would probably excommunicate me. Robbie checked the peephole.
"It's some guy in a suit," he said too loudly.
Whoever was on the other side of the door must have heard him. We watched the shadow beneath the door. I listened closely enough that I could hear the visitor's phone dinging every time he received another text message. What kind of suited men just showed up knocking on strange doors at night? Jehovah's Witnesses, government agents, Satan, the landlord. The man knocked again.
"Miss Crawford," he called, "I just want to talk to you."
"Nobody just wants to talk."
"I'm from CNN," he said. "I want to tell your story."
We waited until midnight, and every time Robbie checked, the reporter was still there. He suggested calling the police, but I didn't want them near me. The police had already cut me open once and left without stitching me back together. The thought of their hands on me again made me nauseous. The man in the hall slipped a note under the door saying,
"I come in peace."
He knew he could wait us out. He knew if he pressured me long enough, I would crack and give him an interview just to get him away from me. He was a man with ambition and an expense account. This made him one of the planet's most dangerous predators. When he came inside, he shook my hand and introduced himself as Artis McClellan. He was so young, he looked like he'd have to wake up in a few hours to take his SATs and then go to soccer practice. I don't know when I got old enough to notice how young people looked. He'd found me because Robbie had posted a picture of me online, sleeping in the fort. He said I'd looked cute, and he wanted to share.
"People should see a better side of you," he said.
I had pulled all of my social media pages down after my arrest. But artists had told me that most of them don't actually go away. They just get harder to find. As he spoke, I considered the exact ways in which I would kill Robbie, the places where I would hide his limbs after I dismembered him, the look of terror in his eyes as I did it. Artists spoke to me for an hour. He wanted to know how the town had changed and what we hoped for in the future. He avoided the word shooting. He did not say murder. Robbie sometimes interjected with his own answers.
"I think she's just scared, like all of us," Robbie said.
Scared. It sounds like the emotion of a child. You get scared of a spider. Artis asked,
What lessons do you think the town has learned from this ordeal?
Lessons? As if we'd just graduated and become American grown-ups because we'd finally bathed in the blood of our neighbors?
I don't understand the question, I said.
What I mean is, would you say this has ultimately made the town stronger?
Robbie nodded and said,
I really think it has. It's like, one day things are terrible, and the next, they're a little better. But eventually you learn how to cope, you know? It's really brought people together.
Do bullets make you stronger? I said. Do you think it's better to get shot or not get shot?
Artis looked to Robbie in that conspiratorial way men have to say, what's with the crazy bitch?
Robbie shrugged.
Listen, Artis said, people don't want stories about how sad people are. They want uplift. They want to feel better.
The president landed at the military airbase at 7 a.m. Then his convoy drove him to Main Street. There he would take a tour of three local businesses, a bakery, a diner, and an antique shop. People loved pastries and lunch and old things, in that order. At 10 o'clock, he would take the stage at the center of the high school football field. Even though I arrived early, it was crowded enough that I needed binoculars to see him on stage. I didn't need to listen to his words, because I had already heard him say the same things before. Behind him, the ghosts sat in the windows and watched, but their faces were emotionless. They looked exactly like students enduring a boring lecture about foreshadowing. They did not care what he said. Because people were afraid he was going to take their guns away, many showed up to his events fully armed. They said it was not a threat. They were just exercising their God-given right to imply murder. They were just reminding everyone of what they could have done if they'd wanted to. Then there was the pocket of counter-protesters, some of whom had smeared fake blood on their faces and dressed as the next victims of a shooting. They held signs saying, "Who's next?" Afterward, the president toured the grounds while media followed and filmed him looking thoughtfully at the places where people had died. He stood in front of the school, head bowed as a priest led us in prayer, and then he was hustled to his car. One news network criticized him for not taking a strong enough stance against guns, and another said he was the most divisive president in history. They said he was a dictator, and they said Hitler started small, too. They suggested he was actually endangering gun owners with his inflammatory rhetoric. On a third network, they talked to a medium who had done freelance investigative work for the police and asked her where she thought the next shooting would take place.
Is there a war on guns? The woman on the TV wanted to know.
I'm not saying there is, she said. I'm just asking the question.
Should guns feel threatened?
The only way to kill a gun is to cut off the hand attached to it. But there are so many hands.
Another truck attack occurred in another European city, and I began to regret all the years I'd spent not fearing automobiles. You grow up surrounded by them, and you use them every day, and so you forget how easily and how often they kill people. First we had paths for our horses, then we had small roads for our cars, then we had interstate highways. Then we started dying at unprecedented rates because it became very important to get to our destinations very quickly. Massive roads are a testament to human ambition, but ambition is what kills you fastest. I wrote a letter to the editor at the Seldom Falls Herald saying we should ban cars. Not just cars, but trucks and motorcycles and anything with an engine.
We should close all the roads, I said. Make them impassable, and plant grass over them and become a society of pedestrians again. We should embrace the natural limits imposed on us by biology. In your life, you only get to travel as far as your own body will take you, and then that's it. The worst thing that ever happened was when men started sailing across the globe to find new places to visit and own
and destroy. No other animal is so self-destructive in its migration. Ban everything besides guns. Ban public space. Ban buildings. Ban trigger fingers. Ban anger. Ban flesh and organs and blood loss. Ban women and children who are easy targets. And ban men who like to shoot at targets. Ban physics and ban velocity. Ban human interaction. How to be safe. Part 2. Make yourself look bigger than a cougar. Raise your arms above your head like a taxidermied grizzly. Purchase clothing that exaggerates your size. Thick-soled boots, trench coats, top hats, baggy t-shirts with horizontal stripes. It is essential to look big, because if you don't look big, then you look small. And if you look small, then you look exploitable. Some venomous snakes and spiders are small and dangerous, but they are the exception, and you are no snake. You are no spider. You are just a person without claws or a venom sac or fangs or built-in camouflage. Your bones feel hard at first, but even mountains crumble under enough pressure. All it takes is a moderately bad fall to break your bones, to release fluid that will pool up around your heart and in your lungs. Your skin rips. Your tissue melts. Your organs are soft, meaty targets. You don't have a sixth sense that can protect you. Your five senses barely work relative to the rest of nature. Wear reflective clothing. You want cars to be able to see you when you're walking around your neighborhood, in an effort to strengthen your legs and your lungs, to improve your outlook on life, which seems like the sort of thing that should happen if you walk around your neighborhood, because the people who do that all appear happy, or at least happy enough. Never walk at night. At night, there is an increased risk of drunk drivers on the road. Plus, the darkness makes it harder to avoid tripping hazards, not to mention the muggers and rapists and, on certain nights, the werewolves. Reflective clothing does not repel werewolves. But it does help drivers to see the moonlight bounce off your vest and sneakers and the adhesive strips you've attached to your walking pants. Self-medicate whenever possible. Whatever drug is helping you to cope is one that will kill you, but at least you're maintaining some control over how and when you go. December. After the journalists were done investigating the boys' house, the scholars had their chance to study it, and then it became a tourist attraction. With Sylvia dead and the mortgage unpaid, the property was assumed by the bank, and the bank wanted to make its money back by charging admission. They promised an insider's view of the environment that creates a monster. Massacre tourism is one of the biggest growth markets in the economy. Small towns across the country allow people to be murdered, and then later the local economy benefits from travelers wandering through town for a couple of days before heading off to the next site of a mass murder. When industry dies, you need to replace the revenue somehow. Some people try to predict the next mass shooting based on risk factors and travel to the sites in anticipation, like tornado hunters chasing funnel clouds. This is what the boys' room looked like. There was a laptop, open to a popular message board, where teens shared racist jokes, stolen pornography, and conspiracy theories. There was a mound of discarded clothing in the corner, a pile of books on the bedside table, exactly the books a smart but pretentious teenage boy would own. Nietzsche, Kerouac, Bukowski, Jim Morrison's poetry. There was a video game system and a stack of games in which the protagonist's job is to murder as many people as possible as creatively as possible. A half-empty pack of cigarettes. It was a profoundly uninteresting room. It was a monument to banality. On the day I went, I was the only visitor. My guide was a man named Herman, who told me he'd wanted to work as a docent in the National Museums in D.C., but had failed the background check. He was doing his time here until another opportunity came along.
Why had he